Welcome to the Tuesday Sports Show.
Good evening, everyone. Thank you very much for listening to the ORN Sport on this Tuesday evening. We will be discussing over the next hour all the sports news from the past week and previewing what's to come over the next 7 days.
Murray wins! Murray wins it all! This is going to be a tough break. Why? Because we're in the World Series! Barrett control this, and the cup is his. He's coming out.
This is URN Sport.
Hello and welcome to the Tuesday Sports Show. We are back after a month and a half off due to varsity. We have returned. Today I'm joined by Arvi, Jack, Jeremy and Chris. Today we're going to be discussing cricket, everything from the Women's World Cup squad to the IPL, as well as tennis, Formula One and the Lions squad. If you want to tune in, you can send us a free web text on www.urn1350.net or tweet us at urn1350. So, Arvi, you're going to start us off with some cricket news.
Oh, thank you, Mo. I would like to start off with IPL. Like, I've been watching IPL just because Mumbai got into the playoffs and I'm from Mumbai back in India. And luckily, they won the IPL for the second time in a row, which was not surprising, having said that they had a good squad, but like having faced Pune Super Giants, which was full of money and had a really good squad as well, I think it was a great achievement for Mumbai Indians, and I don't think any squad has won it back to back twice, so I think it was a really good achievement.
Yes, I mean it's a massive achievement winning the IPL back to back. Obviously, the Mumbai Indians are a big team. You said they beat Pune.
Yeah. They did beat Pune, which consisted.
Jack, you're scrolling your eyes and making weird faces.
I'm saying that because they haven't won it back to back. The Sunrisers Hyderabad, my team, won it last year. They won it in 2015 and 2013.
It's still a fantastic
achievement for the Mumbai Indians. I mean, I haven't really been keeping up to date with it so far this season because purely as I was saying before we came on air, it's come off terrestrial TV. Sky Sports now bought the rights to it because they know that it was getting a viewership on channels like ITV4 where it was before, and now it's, you know, Sky Sports have paid the money and they're getting a lot more publicity out of it. We're seeing a lot more English players go out to the IPL, and you know, Ben Stokes has come out and said that he wants to try and encourage more young English players to go out there and try and improve on their T20 game because the England squad isn't great at T20. But I feel that, you know, for people like myself who don't really have access to Sky Sports, I feel it's a bit of a kick in the teeth. You know, I used to love watching it. Whenever I'd get home, I'd sit down and watch the games, and I think it's just sort of taken the speciality out of it in my mind.
No, I think it's more because of the fact that 2 years ago CSK and Rajasthan Royals were actually suspended from playing, and the owner of Rajasthan Royals was supposedly one of the partners with Sky, like Sky, I guess, to publicize the IPL and just put it out there in all the channels. But like, since they're out, India as a country doesn't have any partner to actually put forward the IPL into any of the streams. So I think that's the reason why this year it's not on any channel. But like, I think next year or the following year it could be back.
I've not really watched the IPL since it started, but I've always sort of followed it, and one of the reasons I follow it is because it's been on ITV, and I think as a group of students who maybe don't have Sky or don't have Sky capabilities, and especially with our really slow internet connections, streaming is a lot of effort. So watching the IPL on ITV is really easy, and I think it's ridiculous that they've got rid of it from ITV and Sky, and I don't like how Sky and BT are buying into all these sports, because when I was growing up, I could watch a Champions League on ITV.
Performances, it just looks different. The last two especially,
it just
seems to be in this
now. You know, I think one small victory is that the FA Cup has actually been won from from places like Sky, from BT, has gone to the BBC, but it's been happening for a while now. You see what's happened with the British Open, what's happened with the Masters, what happened with the cricket. Remember the good old days when the cricket was back on Channel 4? That was brilliant. So, the thing is, though, like, Sky and BT do have the money, and then they're just going to keep making more and more money. And whereas the obviously the BBC are very stagnant in what they could do, is in they've got the money from the taxpayer, whereas Sky and BT are actually designed to make profit. And so eventually, over time, they're able to buy more and more sports. And also, you kind of look at what's happening with the boxing. They've completely monopolized that, for example. So it is a sad trend where you are having to pay money, effectively, to see sports that maybe 10 or so years ago would have been free.
Yeah, I agree with actually everything Chris just said there. I mean, it's really unfortunate that a lot of sports, I mean, cricket, for example, like he's touched on there. I mean, I remember when I was growing up, the famous 2005 Ashes, when, you know, it was that great comeback. I remember watching that on Channel 4, which was fantastic to watch. And nowadays, it's really hard actually to get hold of pretty much a lot of TV coverage for free. If you just sort of, unless you want to go through the Sky or BT, you can't really get hold of a lot of sports coverage anymore, which is, it's really unfortunate. It's nice things like, for example, the FA Cup, and also the Women's FA Cup final gets put on the BBC as well. But aside from that, it's really limiting, and it's something which hopefully they'll change. But it's sort of, at the moment, it's kind of getting worse, because considering there's that new legislation coming in next year for example, all football streams they're going to be having, especially on Premier League, which is going to be an issue. But moving on to regarding cricket, it's kind of a bit of a shame that that is a sport which is also getting pushed back, because, I mean, the fact it was on Channel 4 in the first place was sort of, you know, people knew where to go to watch if you wanted to watch some good cricket, or on IT or on one of the ITV channels to watch the IPL. But now that they've taken off it, it's kind of, well, if you're cutting away some of the content, it's going to retract some of the audience you've got. And in Britain, there is a massive audience potential for wanting to watch things like the IPL. I mean, I'd happily watch a couple of games every season, because I know it is some fantastic cricket they've got down there. And with someone like Ben Stokes, for example, now down there, they've got a massive commercial market. I can understand then that's why Sky and BT decide they're going to corner it. But it's just such a shame that the other channels don't think, well, hang on, this is something which, now that there's some big names playing down there that a lot of English fans are going to be keen on, why don't we try and get in on it? It's a real shame, to be honest.
Hi, this is Kevin Olin, and you're listening to University Radio Nottingham.
Next, we've got some tennis discussion.
So Novak Djokovic has now got rid of quite a large number of his backroom staff. Most notably, Boris Becker has now been replaced as his head coach to, I've already butched this pronunciation once before, but Andre Agassi, I think. Andre Agassi. Now, this is all in light of his defeat in the Rome Masters final, unfortunately for him, to... Now, again, I'm going to probably butcher this chap's name. German Zevre, I think. But he went on to win, and he is now the youngest major. He's now the youngest major winner, which is a hugely impressive achievement for him. But in response to this, Djokovic has now replaced quite a considerable number of his backroom team, which he said that it's not a knee-jerk reaction, and it's not meant to be a long-term commitment. It's just until he'd reasserted his current situation. But with Grand Slam season coming up, obviously, of course, we've got the French Open just around the corner, and then after that, obviously, it's Wimbledon grass court season. It's really interesting that he's chosen this time to get rid of Becker. I mean, he hasn't had the best of form whilst he's been with Becker, to be fair, but I mean, it's something which has come as sort of quite a bit of a surprise out of left field that he suddenly decided to do this in light of losing Rome, and not, say, after when he lost the American Open.
Now, I think the new coach which he has got, Andre Agassi, is actually a good choice, to be honest. Like, having Andre Agassi is someone having won 8 Grand Slam titles, who was like neck to neck at a point with Federer. So I think hiring Andre Agassi was actually a good choice, but like, it was quite weird that he did it after Rome and not after I think the Australian Open. But like, having said that, Wimbledon is coming up, and he probably wanted to give a chance to Boris Becker as well. Having said that, Boris Becker is a big legend, but having Andre Agassi on the back, I think Djokovic is bound to perform well at the Wimbledon Grand Slam.
Yeah, I think the appointment of Andre Agassi is actually a really contentious one, because beforehand he has no formal coaching qualifications, or he's not done anything significant with any player whatsoever. But there's no doubt about it, Andre Agassi is one of the all-time greats of tennis. He's achieved the Grand Slam, he's done what Djokovic has done, and I think Djokovic, you know, since what we saw of him when he won the French Open last year, he's been suffering from injuries, hasn't quite found his form yet. You know, you see what happened to him in the Wimbledon, and also how he crashed out in the early rounds of the Olympics as well. It's just not been very good for him in these last maybe about 7 or 8 months. What is interesting as well is just not just how he replaced Boris Becker, but also how he got rid of Marin Vajda, who was with him for effectively all of his playing career. And so he said it was a bit massive shock therapy, that he needed a shock to the system to get him back going to it. But I just don't see what Djokovic was trying to accomplish by getting rid of all his backroom staff. I do think that's a bit over the top, but you never know, maybe it will work. It depends on how he does in the French Open and then Wimbledon with his new coach Andre Agassi.
I think it's very interesting that he's taken such a drastic change in his backroom staff, because a lot of his game and a lot of his game throughout his career has been reliant on his energy and the way he wears players down. He'll almost look like he's losing the game, but then because of his pure human, beyond human body that he's got, he'll come back and win. And I think maybe the fact that in the last year he dropped down away from the number one, Murray sort of caught up with him, was because of the way he and the pressures he puts on his body, and not because of the coaches. And I think it's he almost needs to look inward and sort of change his game rather than looking outward into his coaching system and changing it.
Yeah, I mean, it is interesting when you compare, for example, his stats versus Murray against Murray versus Federer. Federer quite often has the better on Murray, partly because Federer is a very technical-based player. He doesn't really like to move around the court a lot. He likes to make his opposition do a lot of the running. And against someone like Federer, who has so much energy and can charge around, Djokovic is equally, you know, high-energy style of moving very quickly and trying to catch his opposition off by his raw speed and power doesn't actually come to much fruition. I mean, if he's going to readjust his game, it's probably going to be now. He's going to settle on more, kind of combine the two, maybe use his energies, get himself out of tight fixes, but use his power possibly to really dominate the play and control this a lot more. But that's not really something that we've seen Djokovic really like to ploy. He likes to run the game, but sort of make it quite apparent that he is, you know, the more powerful of the two opponents. I think having had the year that he's had though so far, this kind of does make sense though. The fact that he's decided, right, I need to change, I need a new approach. We've seen with Murray, for example, in between, unfortunately, his final defeat, his defeat in the Wimbledon final, the first time he got there, to then when he won it subsequently the year after against Djokovic, that he made a few changes to his backroom staff and it really did help him come on and grow a lot as a player. So I think that might what Djokovic is thinking. He's taken his step as far as he can go with his current game, and he's achieved some fantastic heights already, but now he's thinking, right, I have got the ability to go that next step, so I need to now reinvent
myself.
Hi, this
is Jeff Stelling from Sky Sports and you're listening to URN Sport.
Thank you, Jeff Stelling. You are listening to URN Sport. Jack, you've got an update on the F1 season of what we've missed so far over the last month and a half.
Yes, thank you very much. Now, just to bring you up to speed, as it stands at the moment, of course, Sebastian Vettel leads the Drivers' Championship by just 6 points coming into the race this weekend. And Mercedes boss Toto Wolff has had some interesting things to say. He says that the rivalry between his Mercedes team and Ferrari so far this year has reignited his love for the sport. Mercedes haven't really been pushed close for the past few years, taking the Constructors' Championship from 2014 to 2016. But Sebastian Vettel of Ferrari, as I say, is now 6 points clear of Mercedes driver Lewis Hamilton. Going into the Monaco GP, which is obviously one of the hotly contested and hotly anticipated races on the Formula One calendar. Toto Wolff has said that he loves the intense competition because it means that you won't be winning easily and you need to have a fierce fight to win, which makes it even more special when you do come out on top. Mercedes, however, have an 8-point lead over their counterparts in the Constructors' Championship, and Hamilton has said that the Monaco GP, with the changes to the car, 20 centimetres wider and with a lot more speed in the straights now and a lot more downforce as well, it's going to be a real test of the driver's awareness of where the car is in relation to the track, and he is sure that some of the cars are going to be brushing up against the side barriers coming into the Monaco GP. Now, guys, I just wanted to ask you a question. What do you think of the rivalry between Ferrari and Mercedes so far this year?
First of all, before I answer that question, I just want to say, first off, that it's great to see Jenson Button back in Formula 1, who is subbing in for... I didn't even think he could do this. He's subbing in for Fernando Alonso, who's gone to the Indy 500. But no, I personally think it's great to see an actual rivalry between teams again, as opposed to a rivalry between people from the same team now that Rosberg is gone. But it's amazing, actually, because in the testing, they were saying that Ferrari could have a good season, but they didn't really expect anything of a real challenge against Mercedes. But yet, suddenly, Sebastian Vettel has kind of refound that form that won him four straight drivers' championships. And even Raikkonen's managed to pull in a pole position, I believe. He came third, not pole position, but podium position, where he came third, I think it was, in the Russian Grand Prix. It's really fascinating to see Hamilton and Vettel go against each other, but also Bottas and Raikkonen are very much in the equation, and it's really good to see actually a proper rivalry between two Formula 1 teams again.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that, you know, it's been so, like, we saw it when Vettel was with Red Bull, you know, he had it all of his own way for three or four seasons in a row, and we, you know, for me as a Formula 1 fan, it sort of got a bit boring after a while, you know, just watching this race where, you know, you see Vettel qualify first and you'd be like, well, there's no point in watching it because we know he's going to go and lead the entire race. And yeah, as a fan, from my perspective, there was really no point in watching it. But now that you've got Ferrari, you know, Ferrari dropped off, of course, over the last few years. Now they're getting themselves back to where they used to be, you know, back as one of the powerhouses in the sport. And yeah, you know, in the Spanish Grand Prix, we heard Lewis Hamilton really trying, you know, he was struggling to get his radio message across across to his garage and his team on the pit lane, because he said, he's come out and said, you know, it was so intense and so physically and mentally demanding that at times he found himself running out of breath just trying to get the car around the track, and because it was, he was being pushed so close by Ferrari and by Sebastian Vettel. Obviously Hamilton came out on top in the Spanish Grand Prix and Vettel came in second. But also what I like to see as well is, you know, Valtteri Bottas won his first Grand Prix as well, which I think is fantastic. You know, we talk about Hamilton being pushed close by Ferrari. I think it's good. You know, we talk about the Rosberg and Hamilton, there was always a bit of a dispute there, but having someone now in Valtteri Bottas who can push him all the way to the limit, I think is fantastic for Hamilton if he wants to keep on improving.
Yeah, we got to also think about the fact that, yes, Valtteri Bottas there has the winning car, to be honest. So he has Rosberg's car. Like, yeah, yes, he is a phenomenal driver, but, like, having said that, he didn't have as much success as he has right now or the year before. I think it's also the winning car doing some magic for him.
I have to disagree with that. I think the car changes so much year to year. I think the fact that in this year of all years, it's been so much more competitive with every race, and I think Bottas would never have won last year if he was in the same car. I think the fact that the cars are so much different, I think what Toto Wolff said, that he's fallen in love with the game again, in love with the sport again, just really sums it up. Because over the last, I don't know, maybe 7 years, you had Vettel winning four in a row, then you had Hamilton winning two, and then Rosberg last year. And even last year, it was like between Rosberg and Hamilton who were in under the same sort of car company. It just got a bit boring, and this year it's going from tit for tat between Ferrari, Mercedes, someone else can come in, Force India, and I think it just makes it a lot more interesting. Maybe not Force India, but I think it's making it a lot more interesting. And I think the fact that someone so big and someone so influential in F1 has come out and said they've fallen in love with the game again just sums it up.
Yeah, it is great to see, though, that, you know, we have now finally, for once in ages, got a bit more of an open season where it could go either way. I mean, like the guy's been saying, for so long in F1's history, it has usually been one team has just been dominating it so much. We've had Red Bull for ages, then it went to, you know, well, actually before then you had Ferrari, then it was Red Bull, then now currently we were in the age where it's sort of really McLaren. Well, McLaren was kind of briefing there, sorry, but Mercedes as well, and there was also Braun, I think, as well. You know, they had that brief season of magnificence where Button finally won his. But it's great to see now that we have actually got a couple of direct teams competing head-to-head, and also a couple of drivers. But I'm just picking up on something which Jack said there. I mean, the thing which is going to be interesting is going to be this week, with Monaco being really the showpiece of all of the F1 events, and the fact that they've changed the cars and made them slightly, you know, they're slightly larger in certain aspects, and they also I think that the designs aren't quite there yet, to be honest, because we saw in Bahrain, every time they were coming down the final straight, there were sparks just flying off the backs of those cars. And I remember watching them, I thought first something had gone wrong, but then they were just sort of, the fact was every single car was doing it. And Bahrain has had probably, I think, the most crashes this year of any of the F1 seasons. And it's quite similar to Monaco in the sense it's very tactical. There's only a few straights where you can overtake them, and it's bent on a lot of twisting corners. But unlike Bahrain, Monaco hasn't got any long runoffs. If you go off, that's it, you're straight into a barrier, and that is going to cause, if there's as many crashes in Monaco as there were in Bahrain, there's going to be someone is going to get badly hurt.
My name is Steve Bunce, and you are listening to the URN Sports Show, the only sports show worth listening to in this neck of the woods.
For the final part of our discussion, Chris will be taking us through the upcoming Lions tour.
Yes, so it's going to be really fascinating to see what does happen, actually. So Billy Vunipola has officially been called out of the series due to an injury, and James Haskell is now in the setup. It's a big loss, obviously. Billy Vunipola, arguably, if not Toby Faletau, was going to start for the Lions against New Zealand, who are overwhelming favourites to win the Lions Tour. It is a big loss, but James Haskell, I believe, is good replacement. I think he'll do a really good job for the Lions. So they've already started training. Sam Warburton, of course, being named captain as well, is arguably big news, because there's the question, of course, is do you think Sam Warburton's worthy of a starting 15 place? A lot of people would say no, but then again, Sam Warburton has won the tour already, having done so in Australia 4 years ago. So everyone's already in Lions mood. It's great to see all the players starting to train for the Lions already. You know, you've got the official photo coming up, but it'll be interesting to see what happens with Warren Gatland's choice of a starting 15 going into the warm-ups and then eventually going into the starting 15 against that first test against New Zealand. It'll be interesting, but I think Billy Vunipola is a big loss, but I do think James Haskell is a good replacement.
Yeah, I think, you know, when you talk about Warburton as the captain of the Lions, he has that experience that not a lot of people in that squad are going to give you. I think having someone like that in your team who can, you know, control situations, and if we do find, we're going to inevitably find ourselves up against it, you know, the number one team in the world in New Zealand. So having that cool, calm and collected head there so that he can, you know, maybe try and calm the team down and get them, really try and re-rally the troops if they do go, you know, a couple of tries down. It's going to be inevitable that our heads are going to drop. The players are not going to be as focused if we go behind by two or three tries, but having someone in Sam Warburton who's that leader figure that you can turn to is certainly going to be certainly going to be beneficial to the rest of the team.
Yeah, the other thing as well, bearing in mind, I mean, we were speculative about whether Warburton should get it. He ended up then, of course, getting it, which we kind of thought would happen inevitably in the end. But the way it's going to probably work out is if we are able to go ahead in the series, it's going to be very interesting then to see what Gatland then chooses to do, because he has form from the last series of... He played Brian O'Driscoll for quite a lot of the series, and then when it was coming down to the crucial match, he actually dropped him in favour of playing other players, because he realised, I think, that O'Driscoll, whilst, you know, great, iconic, sentimental value, the leader that he is, he can show those qualities just as much off the pitch as he can on the pitch. So whether Warburton's going to be staying for the whole series or playing every match, I don't know. I think Warburton personally is past it, and I think he's on the downward decline of his form. But it's going to be interesting if who he chooses with the lineup. If we're able to come out quite well in the first couple of games in the series, and that's going to be fantastic, I'm sure we might be able to push on. But they are going up against the strongest team in the world, and I really am. I know it's really touching wood here if we can do it.
Yeah, I think Sam Warburton is an interesting choice for captain. I do think, despite him maybe, as you said, Jeremy, maybe being almost past it or not good enough, or maybe there being better players around, his experience in the dressing room of playing in such high level, high importance games is so important, especially for the younger players coming through. Chris, you mentioned Vunipola missing out. I think that's going to be a massive loss to the England team. It'll be interesting to see how they cope with it. I think it's an interesting squad that we've picked against the number one team, but we've seen in recent years England beat New Zealand, and I think It'll be interesting to see how we